Welcome to episode 101 of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, what 20 years of litigating nursing home abuse cases has taught me, with Joe Musso.
The Nursing Home Abuse Podcast is dedicated to providing news and information for families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. And now for our special episode, guest lecturer, attorney Joe Musso.
Do today is hopefully help you, but to do that, I kind of have to know a little bit about my audience. So if you could, and I know some of you are just like, oh no, yeah, I'm gonna ask you just a couple quick questions. Is anyone in this room right now the relative or loved one of someone who is in a skilled nursing facility right now? Okay, you folks, I really, really want to talk to. And it doesn't mean I don't want to talk to the rest of you, but I'll be just brutally honest with you. This is what this speech is about. It's about how to advocate for your loved one in a nursing home. How many are ombudsman, advocacy experts? Okay, I want to talk to you too. But I hope, to be honest with you, I hope that for the advocacy experts and those who are protecting families and loved ones in nursing homes as part of their job or their volunteer mission, that you already know a lot of what I'm about to say. I really do hope this isn't shocking stuff to you guys. But maybe it's just another way for you to think about it and wrap your head around it and maybe set your mindset better for what you guys are doing. I see myself and my partner Avery, who's here, as part of the effort with you. I work with advocacy groups and ombudsmen and state surveyors and everyone who's kind of tasked with the mission of protecting our institutionalized elderly. I just take it from a different approach, a different angle, a different side of the equation. I've got about an hour and 10 minutes, something like that, and I could talk to you for 4 hours, 5 hours, I won't, but I could, about what 20 years as a nursing home abuse attorney has taught me that I think will be important to you. I became a nursing home abuse attorney on accident, and I wish I had some great story about how something happened to me or my family member and that drove me to the justice of nursing home residents. It's not. I was a law clerk, I needed a job. My boss came to me and said, there's this stuff going on in Florida back in 1998. People are suing nursing homes for abuse of the elderly and actually making money doing it. And I want to practice like that here at our firm because eventually it's going to get to New Jersey, which is where I was at the time. And I needed a job and I said, okay. And I started a nursing home abuse practice then. Now that's not what kept me in it though for 20 years. Only took me a couple cases before I realized this is what I was supposed to do for the rest of my life. And this is what I will do for the rest of my life. And that's kind of sad too, because I really did have this vision back as a really young lawyer right out of law school that I was gonna be such a difference that it was gonna stop. I say this in every one of my speeches, I would gladly stop suing nursing homes if abuse and neglect would just go away. And unfortunately, I have more cases in 2018, than I've ever had before. And that sucks. So, why you should listen to me. 20 years ago, I started doing this, and this being, I started suing nursing homes for the abuse and neglect of the elderly. I've represented hundreds and hundreds of family, and I've seen every conceivable type of abuse you could imagine. I've seen the rapes, and I've seen the beatings, and I've seen the broken necks and the chokings. I've seen cigarettes put out on people. I've seen stuff that would keep you up at night, because it keeps me up at night. And I still see it. I handled a rape case last month, Avery and I. And never gets easier. I don't seem to get desensitized to it. If anything, I think I get worse, my ability to relate to it. But that's probably a good thing. It's probably why I'm still doing it. I'm also a certified life coach. And unfortunately, my day job does require a lot of hours. But when I do coach, I spend a lot of time coaching caregivers on how to advocate for their loved ones. because it's not that different, believe it or not, from a lot of other things people want to do in the life coaching world, whether it's lose weight, run a marathon, start a business. There is a, what is my objective? What is my goal? What steps do I need to take to get there? What do I need to learn? How do I have to equip myself to accomplish my objective? Today we're going to talk about what the objective should be and how you get there. To get there first, though, you have to have the right mindset, and I'm going to spend some time with you on that. My objectives today were not really my own. My objectives have been given to me for 20 years from my clients. If you have a sense of what a personal injury lawyer is, you might imagine a large verdict comes in and people start popping champagne corks and yay, we won a lot of money, you know? As a nursing home abuse attorney, I've won a lot of money, but I've never had the popping champagne corks moment. There is no popping champagne corks moment. There's no amount of money that makes a family member feel good at the end of my cases. Money is a terrible substitute for the loss of your mom or your dad or your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter from nursing home abuse or neglect on your watch. And I say on your watch because all of my clients feel like this happened on their watch. And for those of you who have loved ones in the nursing home now, you, I'm sure, feel like this is your watch. You're sitting in this room to hear 20 years of lessons from a nursing home abuse attorney because on some level you know that this is your watch. And that's not to put pressure on you. It's to know from 20 years of representing these folks that that's how they feel. One of the greatest things I get to give my clients at the end of the day is evidence that they were not crazy, evidence that they were not wrong about what they thought was happening at that nursing home, the ability to prove that it really did happen, despite the fact that the nursing home told them it didn't happen, the medical director told them it didn't happen, the attending told them it didn't happen, and often the state told them it didn't happen. I am successful in recovering for my clients about 60% of the time when the state fails to substantiate neglect. So what they all say to me, because there is no real money, and it's funny because a lot of my clients come to me, and look, they're suing for money. You know, let's put it out there. They're suing for money. I can't get them anything else. But I can't tell you how often the conversation goes something like this. She was 90. She was beyond her life expectancy. She has no lost wages. She has no future medical bills. She has no financial dependence. And, oh, by the way, there's a gigantic Medicare lien. And because she died and had Medicaid for 30 years, Medicaid's probably going to take all this money. And those clients sit there and say, I don't care. It's not about the money for my clients. Money is a medium. It's something that they can use to sleep at night to know that they were not crazy, that they got to prove it. And they're often more concerned about making that nursing home pay than they are about getting money from that nursing home. It's not about what they put in their pocket, it's what comes out of their pocket to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And there's a real good reason for that, as we're going to talk about in a minute, because money matters to nursing homes. It's a language they understand. And so my clients speak it through me. And what they say is, when I ask them, well, why do you want to keep going if you know you're not going to get any money? It's always the same thing. I'm going to do this so it doesn't happen to someone else. Cynical me, when I was young, didn't really believe that. I used to believe that's what they'd say, but really, they were suing for money. But the longer I've done it, the more I know it's true. Just recently in this case that I resolved with Dave about, that was a rape case, I literally told that client she was not going to get any money. That literally, you could not get any money out of this case. There was no way we were going to get any money for you. She didn't even blink. She didn't even blink. So what? I don't want this to happen to somebody else. And so what I'm going to talk to you about today is for 20 years of folks like him, Mr. C, who died from one of the most common complications facing him that any reasonable nurse, any reasonable doctor should have known about, and that symptom occurred 100 times, and they never did anything about it, and he died, and he left his wife of 64 years alone when he shouldn't have died. And it's for Mrs. M, who was on a pureed diet, and they gave her a Reuben sandwich and left her alone in the day room, and she choked to death. It's for my very first client, Mrs. T, who was 100 years old, my very first client, who walked from her room at the end of that facility, past two nurses' stations, and out the back door of dietary that they had tied open so that they could get some breeze, who fell off the loading dock where they bring the food in and was run over by the delivery truck that afternoon. It's for Mrs. F, who fell out of the third floor window of a secure dementia unit. It's for Mrs. J, who broke her neck down the stairwell because the pad that had the locks on it was fake. There really wasn't any code. They would literally go to it and punch it in to make people think there was a code, but there was nothing behind that wall. And she went into the stairwell and down it and broke her neck. It's for the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of residents that we see that come in, or families that come into us and say, she got a fever, they sent her to the hospital, the nurse pulled back the sheets, and a gaping stage 4 wound the size of a cantaloupe was on her backside. And she had a fever because she was septic, and they told me there was nothing they could do, it was down to the bone, and she died a terrible death 3 days later. That one I see every week. It's for all of them. All of them who sat across from me at some point and said, I wish I knew that. Because every one of them has a component to their story where they, had they known something, that outcome could have been different. And let me be very clear about that, because I get very weird looks when I say that sometimes in my speeches. I'm not blaming my clients. I love my clients. I work for my clients. I believe my clients. I would never do what I do if I thought it was their fault. It's not their fault. They're in a system that is built to keep them in the dark. It's built for them not to have enough information. And we're going to talk all about why that is today, too. But there is a moment in almost every single one of my clients that if my clients knew something, the outcome would have been different. They would have done something different. They wouldn't have trusted something that was said. They wouldn't have left them in a situation had they known about it. Knowledge is power when you're advocating for a nursing home resident. If you take nothing else from that, from this speech today, take that. Because knowledge could have prevented just about every single one of my cases. So I want to start with getting your mind around the idea of advocacy. I'm a lawyer, I'm a trial lawyer. I persuade people for a living, whether it's juries, defense attorneys, colleagues, adjusters, judges. I persuade people to do things that I want them to do. And ultimately, that's what advocacy is. It's what it is for you too, whether you're an ombudsman or an investigator or a resident or a family member. When you're advocating, you're persuading. And Cicero's comment on advocacy is wonderful. If you wish to persuade me, you must think my thoughts, feel my feelings, and speak my words. As a young lawyer, I used to make these great arguments about that I should win this case, and I'm going to tell you my story, and I'm going to give you all these facts. And they were great for me. They were great for the white, 28-year-old, second-year lawyer, conservative-leaning, politically Christian. My arguments were terrific for that guy. Problem was, I wasn't talking to that guy half the time, more than half the time. And so I found myself frustrated with, gosh, this was such a great argument. And I ran it by my brother, who happens to be the exact same person I am, and he loved it too. And then I got in front of that jury in Camden County, New Jersey, and they didn't get it. You have to know who it is you're talking to. Advocacy begins with empathy. It's sitting in the recipient of your advocacy's situation and saying, what is it that they want? Because if you're trying to sell them something that you want, you're not going to get very far. The moment I understood that advocacy was about what the other person needed, what the other person wanted, my ability to persuade changed dramatically. And so will yours. I wish I had some magic phrase or specific language, some words I could say that would guarantee that your resident or your loved one was going to get the best care they could possibly get, that they would maintain the highest practicable physical, psychosocial, and emotional well-being at the facility. I don't have that. What I've got is a mindset that says, if you are thinking like the nursing home, and your behavior and your actions are actions they care about, not you ranting and raving and yelling, because they don't care about that, you will be far more effective in whatever advocacy you're making. Now, if you don't follow the rest of the plan, which is being knowledgeable, involved, aggressive, polite, won't go very far anyway. But you can do all of those things, but if you do it the wrong way, screaming, yelling, berating, you do it that way, you're not going to get anything other than labeled as a troublemaker, and all of a sudden a bunch of pretexts are going to come out about why your resident doesn't belong there, and the next thing you know, you're probably dealing with an unlawful discharge problem. So, with the basic framework of knowing who your target is, let's unpack that and get your mindset right before I start to tell you about the specific lessons from my 20 years. Take a good look at that. The second thing that, if you take nothing else away from it, I want you to take away is this. A nursing home is a business. There's few things more important as an advocate that you understand than a nursing home is a business. We have this terrible problem in America. We put emotions and morals on corporations. That is a terrible thing to do if you're advocating in a nursing home. It doesn't make a lot of sense in a lot of ways, quite frankly, and I don't mean to rile anyone up politically, but the truth of the matter is you can look to the Citizens United decision and say that corporations are people, but they're not. You can say, oh, well, we're going to make every single business give full-time employees benefits and health care, regardless of pre-existing condition. But you should not be shocked when everyone becomes a part-time employee. You can say, we need to raise the minimum wage, we need to raise the minimum wage. But you should not be shocked when they take the guy working on fries and the guy on lettuce and they combine their job. Because that's what corporations do. Corporations are about profit. That's what they're about. And a nursing home is a business. What they care about is their profit. Now let me stop. For some of you up there going, there's some good nursing home people. I know good nurses. Of course you know good nurses. I know a lot of corporations that are filled with wonderful people. They are still in the context of a business whose only job it is to make money. You lower a corporate tax rate, they stay. You raise the corporate tax rate, and all of a sudden they become unpatriotic. It is simple cause and effect with a business. When you advocate for a loved one, you must know that they are a business. And what the business cares about, you must align with. And we're going to talk about that. So I want to talk to you about one way that the business of the nursing home really impacts us as residents, family members, and advocates. Because, again, from my tone or from the fact that I've sued nursing homes for 20 years, or, you know, you could get the sense that I just don't like nursing homes. And it's really not true. I don't like bad care. I think nursing homes are brutally important to our society. I just don't like bad care. Now, here's the reality. We come across, Avery and I come across, nursing homes that really couldn't care less about human beings. But they're exceedingly rare. Exceedingly rare. There are not a lot of nursing homes and their staff members and their administrators and their business people that are like, you know, screw them. Who cares if they fall and break their neck? Who cares if they get killed? That's not what we really deal with. I mean, come across a couple of them, but it is by far the exception to the rule. Now, what we do come across all the time, is a business that is trying to operate at peak efficiency. Now, let me explain what peak efficiency is, okay? We don't really need peer-reviewed journals, but there's a whole lot of them out there. that says there is a direct relationship between the level of staffing in your facility and positive outcomes, or negative outcomes, depending on if they're low. Did you need a peer review journal for that, though? Let me ask you this. If you woefully understaff a McDonald's, does service suffer? If you woefully understaff a Target, does service suffer? If you walked into a Target and nobody was there, shelves would be empty, no one around to ring you up. Of course, in a service industry, staffing levels matter. Of course they do. There is a point, it's this fictitious line that runs through this business. On this side of the line, if you staff at this level, you have a much more increased chance of having no problems. For example, if you had a choice between going to a nursing home that had one nurse and one aide for every resident, would you prefer that over the one that has one aide, no nurse for 35 residents? Again, very common sense, right? Very simple. Well, now take the continuum, because no one has one-on-one staffing ratios. Take that continuum, and somewhere in there, there's a line. And that line is the area of optimal business efficiency. It is the place where, if you add one more nurse, one more aide, you might get a little bit better care, but no one gets less hurt. And there's a line where just under that line, someone might get hurt, but might not. And then, of course, over here, pretty likely someone's going to get hurt. And all the way over there, you're going to have a whole bunch of happy people, but you're going to go broke. They're looking for optimal. The nursing homes that are not bad, not evil, not, you know, really, you know, feeding dog food to people to try to make money, they're just trying to be optimal efficiency. They're trying to get to that line and right on it and not miss. You ever mess up at your job? When they mess up at their job, they just shot the wrong way. They just got a little bit less than optimal, and someone ends up getting hurt. The staff are not the business. The administration and the owners are the business. So let's have a real honest conversation about the staff, because, again, we seem to go into la-la land with this idea that because they're nurses and because they're aides, that somehow they operate different than every other human being in on our planet. But they don't. Do you know what the nursing home is to the DON, to the assistant DON, to the charge nurse, to the LPN, the floor nurse, to the aides? It's a job. It's a job. You can look at all of the slick marketing material that says, we will treat you like, if you believe that, you're crazy. Nobody who is paid to care for a stranger is going to care for your loved one like you are. So stop believing that nonsense, because it is nonsense. It is never true. Even the very best ones that treat them as good as you would have treated them would treat their own mom better. Right? It's a job. Statistically speaking, 10% of you love your job. 90% of you wish you were doing something else. 87% of you, according to statistics from labor statistics, 87% of you are in your current job because changing careers would be too difficult or your responsibilities at home keep you in the job you have. 87%. That's a ton of people. 88% of you are doing something right now that you thought when you went into the field would be very different than it is. 35% of you are actively looking for work right now. Do you think than an aide, who makes minimum wage, who gets spit on at least once a week, who gets screamed at, who cleans bedpans for a living, who works ridiculous hours, isn't somewhere in this list of statistics? It's a job. It's their job. Have you ever had a bad day at work? Have you ever surfed the web instead of focusing on what you were supposed to do? Have you ever chatted with your friends instead of doing what you were supposed to do? Do you really think that the aide and the nurse don't have these problems? Of course they do. It's a job. So, as advocates, you now know the nursing home administration and ownership is a business that wants to make a profit and doesn't want to get sidetracked with anything that doesn't make a profit. And you know the staff, the direct line caregivers, want to do their job, not get harassed, not lose their job, not get their job threatened, and not become unemployed. Because that's what we all want as people who have jobs. So, with the mindset that a nursing home is a business and for the staff it's a job, we come to this, which is knowledge is power. When you're dealing with staff members, when you're dealing with physicians, when you're dealing with ownership, when you're dealing with administration, you can't do a whole lot without knowledge. And let me press pause for a moment. Let me acknowledge something that I sense some family members don't really want to face. I had a friend of mine, actually a colleague of mine, I said, he looked great. He looked like he lost 50 pounds. And I asked him, I said, how'd you do it? I'm always looking, how'd you do it? And he says, oh, diet and exercise. There's a part of me that went, ugh. Because what do you want to hear, right? It's this new drink. There's this new pill. All I had to do was sleep with a cantaloupe next to me. You know, we're all looking for that easy way to accomplish a tough task. You are not going to advocate for your loved one in a nursing home when you are only coming there visiting however long you can, in between going to your job, caring for your kids, paying your bills, going to work, everything else you're doing without effort. You're not. You're not going to be able to actually accomplish what you want to accomplish without preparation, without taking some time on your weekend to plan how are you advocating this week. What is the crucial thing happening this week that I, as an advocate for my mom, dad, brother, sister, need to do to make sure this goes right this week? It is work. It is a part-time job. I wish it wasn't. I wish I could tell you, you should just delegate it to them. No, you cannot delegate it to them. Another thing besides, I hope it never happens to anyone else that I hear from all of my clients, I trusted the professionals. No, you do not trust the professionals. Doesn't mean you don't respect the professionals until they give you a reason not to. It doesn't mean you don't want to collaborate with the professionals. It doesn't mean you're hoping the professionals are great. It doesn't mean that you're not going to work with them, provide information for them, support them, encourage them, catch them doing things right. Of course. I'm not telling you to be nasty. You don't make it harder on yourself. But trust the professionals with your loved one. If I put my dog in a kennel, I visit 3 times before I ever think about it. I ask questions. I want names of people who are going to be taking care of my dog while I'm gone for the weekend. This is your mom, your dad, your brother. Do not trust the professionals. But that's the problem, isn't it? The problem is the reason you're trusting the professionals isn't because you intellectually think it's a good idea. You kind of already know you can't trust the professionals. When I walk into a courtroom and I say, the nursing home chose profits over people, the jury's like, huh? No one's like, no. They're all like, yeah, of course they did. When I say it to loved ones, family members, when I say I'm a nursing home abuse lawyer, I, unlike a lot of my colleagues, do not get the ambulance chaser. I don't get that. What I get is good for you. Oh, we need that. Everyone knows you don't trust the professionals in a nursing home to take care of your loved one. But you get forced to. The truth is, you're lying to yourself. You're saying, I'm trusting the professionals because I didn't want to spend the time to learn everything I would need to learn to hold them accountable. I'll give you an example. 3 weeks ago, we just got done cooking dinner, and the upstairs was really hot, which is sometimes happens when I have the stove on too long. So my wife and I kind of said, we'll just let it go a little bit. The stove's been off now for like 10 minutes. Any minute now, it'll start to cool down. But there, that number just sat there. It wasn't coming down. The next thing you know, it started going up. The next thing you know, it was 85 degrees in my house. My dog was miserable. My wife was miserable. My kids, we were all miserable. Our air conditioner died. Instantly, I am into, gotta fix this because my wife's going to kill me if I don't. And I start talking to people about air conditioners. I talk to air conditioner, HVAC people. And they start telling me a lot of great stuff. Because what I need is a dual variable, 16 SEER, American standard, variable speed air conditioner with an 80,000 BTU furnace. That's what I need. I have no idea what any of that means. None. So I start talking to people. Oh, and by the way, that costs $10,000. And so I start talking to people, and I start hearing things like, well, you don't need 16 SEER, that's ridiculous. You need 14 SEER. At 16 SEER, you'll save $200 a year, but it'll take you 8 years to make that back. Because it costs $1,600 to go from 14 days to 16. Oh, and by the way, you had a 14 the first time. I wasn't looking to upgrade my air conditioner. You don't need dual variable speed. You have standard speed, and that's what you had the first time. I wasn't trying to get a better air conditioner. I just wanted it to come down. It was hot. I had to learn all of this language I didn't understand. I had to learn all of this stuff. And they had all of the information because they were the experts. And they would have raked me over the coals. Because the conversations got so different. Once I started turning around and saying, 14 SEER is only going to save me $200 a year. You're going to charge me $2,000 for that? It'll take me 9 years to get that back. All of a sudden, well, Mr. Musso, I see that you understand. All of a sudden, very different. I don't need variable speed. Why are you trying to sell me that? Okay, let me show you this. I remember I had this big fight about American Standard and Trane until I figured out that they're literally made by the same company, have the same warranty, the same parts, everything about them is the same. They're just different names on the same damn thing. I give you this example because knowledge is power. They would love to sit there and tell you all of the things that are way over your head that you can't possibly understand. Bullshit. You can understand all of it. Everyone in this room that got here today by being able to plug something into a GPS, or for those of you who actually got on a plane and got here, you can learn everything you need to know to be able to sit there in an interdisciplinary care plan conference and say to the physical therapist, well, what are we going to do about her orthostatic hypotension? She keeps falling down. With a couple of clicks, a Google, you can totally figure this out. You need a notebook. You need a notebook that lists the diagnoses, that lists the medications, that lists who gave you the medications, why they gave you the medications, when it was changed, which one came after, which one came first, and what happened to your loved one when they did. Yeah, it's work. Yes, it's work. It's taking time. But I'll bet you could free up some of that time. Anyone been on Twitter or Instagram this morning? Just give that up. Know about the nursing facility. They don't want you to know about the nursing facility. You should know about the nursing facility. You should know about what it's like, what the residents think of it. Ask to speak to the administrator. Now, I'm talking in those situations about someone who has the luxury of being able to go and check the place out. I understand sometimes you're just not in that spot. Sometimes it's you're at a hospital and they say, hey, you got to leave tomorrow, and this place has a bed over here. I get it. If you have the luxury, though, certainly you want to go and ask to speak to the administrator. You want to say, I'd like to see the head of your resident council. I'd like to talk to him or her, see what she thinks about the place. Hey, I'd like to see your last three surveys. I'd like to see what you guys, how your report cards look. And I love this one. My associate, my partner Avery, taught me this one. Job reviews. You go to Indeed.com, you punch the nursing home in, and all of these nurses and aides start putting things like, I wouldn't put my dog there. What are some of the ones I have? They are totally understaffed. I've never been so afraid for my residents. If I saw that on a job board, I might ask some questions. I might be a little, I don't know about that. Stealing medications is rampant here. Management is absolutely clueless. Everything is about the bottom line. It's not the Bible. These are disgruntled employees who may have gotten fired for stealing medications themselves. But it's good to look at it. It's good to know it, because if you had that, and the resident council kind of gave you the, no, I wouldn't come here. And if you got a copy of the you went to Medicare.gov and you went to the nursing home compare site and you saw that it's one star and it's got a bunch of, hires a bunch of criminals and it's got a bunch of bad reviews and a bunch of bed sores and the quality indicators are terrible, and you speak to the administrator but she doesn't have time for you, maybe you make a different decision. But if you're not in that situation, you still need to know all this. If you're in the situation where you're basically like, I gotta take it, I gotta go here because I can't have her in the street, and she just had a stroke, and this is the only place they're giving me, you may be looking for a new place right as soon as you get there, but it's still better to know what you're dealing with. Don't ever judge a place by its lobby. Never. And never judge a place by its marketing director or its business office. Okay? Again, common sense, right? You wouldn't do that with daycare, would you? You'd want to go see the room, see the classroom, meet the teacher. You should know the nursing process. I'm going to give you a crash course on it right now. You should understand the APIE, A-P-I-E. Do people not know what I'm talking about when I say the nursing process? Good, most of you know. All right, assessment. I'm going to go over it anyway, just in case there's anyone who doesn't. Assessment. What kind of problems is your mom, dad, brother, sister having a problem with? Why are they here? What kind of issues are they facing? What kind of risks do they have that we want to not let materialize? Pretty simple. The CMS, the new CMS guidelines and everything, it's all very much resident participation, family participation. We were just having this conversation, Avery and I, about that's great with an informed, armed resident or family. That's great. But you know the truth, in my experience, they're not real interested in you participating. They really don't want to sit down and go, let's talk about mom and how we can maximize her recovery. They're busy. It's a job. It's a business. Having a bunch of people off the floor to come talk to you and spend a half an hour going over just your resident, like an interdisciplinary care plan conference, takes staff off the floor, makes the job harder for the staff, and doesn't help with profit. Okay, we're aware. Business, work. But it's very important you're involved. Assessment. You have to be involved in the assessment and the care plan process. What are the issues facing your loved ones? Do they fall? If so, how? When? Why? Whatever you know. You know, we talk about leave it to the experts, the big mistake. I trusted the experts. You are the expert on your loved one. They will never be the expert on your loved one. They can be the expert in medicine. They can be the expert in nursing. And by the way, with a little education, you'll be a better expert than them in nursing. You can be just as good an expert in medicine. But I will admit that will take some effort. It takes no effort to be the expert on your loved one. You know more than them about that. And you should not be shy about that. You should know what the plan is. So when they assess your resident with your help, I want to see the care plan. They will actually have a written care plan. I want to see it. They won't like that you want to see it. You should have a copy of it. You should have a copy of it every time it gets changed. You should know before it gets changed why it got changed. It's amazing that no one thinks that they should have that. I can't tell you how many clients come to me and say, they changed her meds apparently, and she just started having all sorts of problems. And I go, well, why did they change the meds? Oh, I don't know. They didn't tell me until afterwards. That's insane. That's insane. You have to know what they're doing, why they're doing it. Let me see the care plan. Why are you doing this? And if this sounds like common sense, it is. But I can't believe how something happens when they, and I'm gonna talk about this a little bit when we talk about residents' rights. I got this thing about residents' rights, and I know it's Residents' Rights Month, so I'm really taboo here. They have all the rights we have. There's no special residents' rights. It's the rights of a citizen. It's the rights of a human being in the United States of America. We immediately go to this idea like, well, what rights do they retain once they go into the nursing? What? But we talk about it. I mean, crap, there's an entire month for residents' rights. So, you know, learn them. Learn them. You have them. And if you have them, they have them. I get annoyed by the whole phrase. You can cut that from the video if you want. The plan matters, all right? The plan matters because this is a real case. This is a real fact pattern. A resident is a fall risk, and they use something called the Tinetti's fall scale, which is just a standardized bunch of questions to figure out that he or she will fall. She's not ambulatory, okay? So she doesn't walk. She needs a wheelchair to get around. And all of her prior falls have been essentially out of bed at home. She has some perception issues. She has some safety awareness issues. She seems to forget that she's incontinent. She also seems to forget that she can't walk. So what happens is she has trouble finding the edges of her bed because of her perception issues. She has urinary urgency. She forgets where she is. She gets up. Boom, she falls. That's the fact pattern. It's happened multiple times at home. Now she's in a nursing home. And they identify her as a fall risk. And then they come up with a care plan. And the care plan includes keep the room free of clutter and non-skid socks. She doesn't walk. She's not going to trip on clutter. And her socks having a skid on them, non-skid on them, does nothing for her. Her bed isn't in the lowest position, it's not against the wall, there's not a mat on the floor, and they don't have her on a toileting plan to control that urinary urgency that she keeps having in the middle of the night that drags her down. So when she falls out of an elevated bed onto a hard floor in the middle of the night because she thinks she has to go to the bathroom because nobody took her toileting before she went to bed and she breaks her hip on the floor, they turn around and go, but we had a care plan. Think about whether or not the things they put on their care plan, because again, in the effort to be a business of efficiency, they've moved now from, let's think about what we're going to do to prevent falls for Mrs. Jones, and they're much more at a computer desk going, fall prevention was triggered, okay, check, 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 check. You can actually have a problem with too many interventions. Right? We had a case one time, they came in, they said, everyone's a fall risk. We don't even assess them anymore. Everyone's a fall risk. We just treat them all like fall risks. And I always say, but aren't you taking resources away from people who are actually fall risks and spending them on people who are not? And they just looked at me like, but everyone's a fall risk. It's even better. Not in a world of limited resources, it's not. You're endangering real fall risks when you spend time trying to prevent falls and people who aren't going to fall. Take a look at that care plan. See what it is and ask the question, does this make any sense? My mom doesn't walk. Non-skid socks aren't her problem. Her problem is she tries to get up in the middle of the night. So let's try to toilet her before she goes to bed. Know your residents. We talked about this briefly, and since I've only got 20 minutes. This kind of goes back a little bit to the residents' rights things too. You know, if you hear things like, well, we get up at 7 a.m. here. No, you don't, because my mom doesn't like to get up till 9. She's not in the Army. She doesn't suddenly have to get up at 9. What does she like to eat? What does he like to do? What does he like to play? I mean, if you can give your dad a recording of every Dodgers game that's ever happened, it'll make him happy as a lark. Shouldn't you do that? there's something about putting someone in a nursing home where we kind of make this assumption it's got to be awful. And it's part of the whole system. It's part of the business. It's part of the marketing. It's part of our collective beliefs about it. It's the same belief that makes us go, what are our resident rights for a nursing home resident? Because we don't just say they're human beings. They're just like us. They get why wouldn't they be able to have their favorite show? Why wouldn't they be able to have their favorite book? Why wouldn't they be able to do their favorite activity? Why wouldn't they be able to see their favorite people? When they want, by the way. Become an expert on your loved one and make sure you're communicating your expertise to the nursing home, and be very, very leery if the nursing home doesn't care. If you start saying, she really loves green plants, well, we don't have those. That's a problem. I'm going to bring them in, and they better be there when I come back next week. You know, she really likes, he's an early riser, he's a Marine, loves getting up at 5:55 in the morning. Well, we do MedPass, and we like to try to get them out of bed around 7. No, my father likes to be out of bed at 5:55. This is the one that gives everyone the most trouble. Some of it is just that there's this period of time where mom or dad really just didn't want you in their medicine. You know, my dad didn't tell me he had cancer. He didn't tell me he had a heart problem until he had a heart attack. And I talked to the doctor, and now I'm with dad. Doctor says, Pete, this is your third heart attack. I'm like, what, your third heart attack? When the hell did you have two heart attacks? You know, and he didn't tell me because he was Brooklyn Italian and who didn't think that the son should have anything to do with that. So some of it's just that it's been hidden from you. And now all of a sudden you're in this and it's like, I got to go gather up this material. But gather it up. Go get it. Find a way. If you know one doctor, start there. Build the trail. Take the records. Take a look at them. What other doctors are mentioned? Take a look at the pill bottles. Who prescribed this stuff? Start creating your notebook. You should have a notebook. Okay, it's in beta, but I'm working on it. The Empowered Caregiver Journal, which is simply a place to store all of that stuff. Medications, doctors, changes, effects. Write it down. I mean, this young lady's got a book right here just to hear me talk for 20 minutes. If you're caring for somebody, you should have a book. And then you should be writing in the book. There is, every medical diagnosis. I want you to have in your book every medical diagnosis. And, it could be a lot. And I want you to know when every medical diagnosis was made. And I want you to know who made every medical diagnosis. And I want you to be able to list every treatment, medication, surgery that the resident had for each medical diagnosis. And I want you to tell me any allergies or medication reactions that you know about. And yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot of work. That's a part-time job. I get it. But you need that information at your fingertips. This goes right along with it. You don't just need to know the meds, you gotta know who sent them, who prescribed them, who created this. Were they created before or after the last one? You'd be amazed at what they don't know about each other. And we're getting better at it now with electronic not yet, but we will be getting, I think we will eventually with the technology be able to pull it up and go, here's the order of how things happened. But we're still a little ways away from it. Right now, though, it's very often they don't have any idea what the last one did and why. And they just, we'll just up this and add that. And then you're gone from that guy. And it just carries forward. Things just carry forward. We see things that are just wrong in medical records, and it is impossible to get them out. And next thing you know, people are relying on them. Well, they were there. And they come in, they want an addendum. My clients want an addendum. I got to get this removed. They keep on trying to treat this thing. That was my mom, not my dad. It was a mistake. And it just carries over and carries over and carries over. But I want you to think for a second about what it's like if you have this information in your notebook. You have all the medications, all the diagnoses, who made them, where they are, what the contact information for all the healthcare providers is. If you actually did that work, if you took a weekend and really just hit it and got all that information into a notebook, and you're having a conversation with staff or an attending physician, or you're at an interdisciplinary care plan conference, or you're at the hospital, and you're saying things like, well, Dr. Smith prescribed that for hypertension in 2012, know, maybe we should call Dr. Jones and find out if he's okay with withdrawing that treatment right now. Let me give you the contact info for that physician who's been dealing with the issue, and you can reach out to them directly, or I'll just call Dr. Smith myself since I have it right here. Or you're going to have a conversation that says, I don't know who prescribed that. I'm not sure how long she's been taking it. I don't know whether that medication was prescribed before or after the other one. Well, if you say I should it should be discontinued, I guess it should. Do you see the difference in the level of advocacy you have? And now go back to our beginning. It's a business and it's a job. The business doesn't want you that prepared. The workers sure as hell don't want you that prepared. What do they want? We got it, Mrs. Smith. We got it. They're not going to encourage you to do this. You pop out with a notebook. Well, let me ask you this. If anyone showed up on your job, you know who I hate to represent? God, they're the worst. They're the worst. Have you filed your interrogatories yet? What time are you filing your complaint? What is your strategy for taking the depositions? Who are you going to depose first? Can I sit next to you? It's the worst. It's the worst. Lawyers are the worst. So what do you think happens when you pop out your notebook and you just said, well, really, do you think you should be giving her an antihypnotic? Have you tried any kind of behavioral therapies yet before starting giving her Seroquel? And they go, oh, shit, she knows. And that's what they do. They'll be like, oh, man, she knows. You might even get a face. That's good. You get that face, you're doing it right. You get a gold star from Joe if you get that face. This seems real obvious to me. If I walk into Target, they have a big name tag, and they say, hi, I'm Joanne, can I help you get anything? If I walk into a nursing home, they're all wearing scrubs, no one's got a name tag, and no one wants to tell me their name. If you went to your kid's daycare center, and you asked to visit the place, and you went in, and anyone refused to tell you their name, would you bring your kid there? Would you bring your dog there? I mean, if you wanted to see the actual teacher in your kid's classroom, not just the principal, not just the business manager, but you wanted to actually see the person who was going to be running the daycare center in your kid's classroom, and they said, well, we don't know who that is. That changes every day. What would you say to yourself? Well, then you're going to have to give me a schedule. But we don't do that in a nursing home because there's something about going into a nursing home where we suddenly think that we're not allowed to ask who's taking care of my mom. And they're more than happy to let you think that's normal. We got a lot of people here. Well, sounds like you should write those names down then for me. Well, we have temp agency. Why do you have a temp agency? You know what I mean? Like, ask a question. Follow up. Notice, by the way, for humor, I might act a little sharper than you should be. I'm really not asking you to be rude. I'm really not. But I am asking you to stop thinking it's normal that you can't have a conversation with the director of nursing when your mom gets the wrong medication and no one seems to know who gave it to her. And in your little book, you're going to have things like, well, I spoke with Sally Jones, who's the CNA on the 7-3 shift, and she told me my mom was going to get a specialty mattress that morning. And now, Director Jones, here I am 1 week later, and that mattress doesn't seem to be on my mom's chair. So I'm wondering whether or not it's you or the administrator I need to speak with, Mrs. Smith, who's down the hall, who I'll be speaking with next if you can help me get that mattress on my mom's bed. That is such a different conversation. Then someone told me I was getting a special mattress. I don't know when, I don't know who it was. They were wearing scrubs, you know? So getting back to this, insist on names. And if someone doesn't want to give you the name, really insist on the name. If someone's like, well, why do you want my name? There's a real problem with that. There's just nothing good about someone who's caring for, you know, frail, vulnerable human beings that can't say, my name is Sally Smith, I'm the CNA from 7-3, and I'm absolutely honored to take care of your mom. What can I help you with? Because if it's anything other than that, like, I don't tell you my name, you got a problem on your hands. I already talked about this. You know your rights. You should know them, all right? I mean, but start from the premise of they're the exact same rights you or I have. Because if I came to you right now and I said, you know, you can't, if a cop came to you and said, you can't wear that shirt outside, that shirt supports a certain political candidate and we don't allow that in this town, you'd be like, well, my First Amendment rights say I can. If someone's, you know, if all of a sudden our president or somebody came out and said, round up all the guns in the country, we're going to put them into a pit, burn them, you'd all go, my Second Amendment right says you can't do that. If we shut down all the newspapers and let the government control it, you'd say, my First Amendment says you can't do that. We know our rights. We can't know if our rights are violated, though, if we don't know them. Right? That's simple. So if they come to you and they say, you can visit between 1 and 1:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you might think, because of all the other psychotic things that nursing homes have you believing, that that's okay, that that's normal. That, well, I am going into another building, so maybe they are in charge here. They're not. You are. Your loved one has the right to see you basically whenever you guys want to see him, as long as it's not harming anyone else. Well, your lawyer's coming here? Well, we're going to need to talk to our lawyers about that. And we're going to need to have the administrator come down here and escort him, and we're going to get risk management. And they're here October 23rd. So if your lawyer can come at 7 a.m. on October 23rd when our risk manager will be here, then we'd love to have your lawyer here. No. My lawyer's coming here in 20 minutes because my resident is allowed to have her lawyer here whenever she wants. And a priest and her friends and her mom and her sister and whoever else she wants. Because she doesn't lose that right because by virtue of being in a nursing home. That's insane. All right, so this is about enforcing your rights, okay? It's important to know them. It's important to understand the difference between a business, the business interests, and the workers' interests. But now you need what I call levels of escalation. You don't pull out the nuclear missile the first time, you know, a sweatshirt's missing, right? Levels of escalation. Because the real goal is not to be a rude pain in the ass to these people who are really trying to do a very difficult job. I also want to point out that you should be catching them doing things right. There's something very powerful about coming in and seeing your mom in clean diaper, clean linens, clean everything, and going over to that aide who you know and you have her name, and she doesn't mind giving you her name because you're sweet, and you come up to her and you say, I just wanted to let you know, you did a wonderful job with mom, and I know that's not easy. She can be a little rough around the edges when she gets agitated, and she looks wonderful. She smells great, she's clean. Thank you so much for what you do every day. And you know what, I want to go talk to your boss. That's a cool thing to do. I mean, would you like that on your job? So again, remember, for them, it's a job. When they do something right, carrot. You know, I'm not just teaching you when they do something wrong, crack them with the stick. Carrots are great. Encourage good behavior. Encourage good things. Help them in their job. Give them a reason to do their job well. But when you run into problems, if you run into a problem, you want to go levels of escalation. So you're going to go to the charge nurse. I came to visit Saturday, mom was in a dirty diaper. I come to visit today, mom's in a dirty diaper again. It doesn't seem like I ever show up when mom's in a clean diaper. Charge nurse, can you tell me, you know, either she just seems, and I rotate my visits, so it's not just that that's when she goes to the bathroom. I'm getting concerned she's sitting in her diaper too long with it's dirty. Okay, we'll take care of it, great, great, great. Happens again. I'm gonna talk to the director of nursing. director of nursing, I spoke with Sally Smith, the 7 to 3 charge nurse. I explained to her that mom's been sitting in a dirty diaper a few too many times. I rotate my visits. I come at different times. I come different days, and I keep finding her in a dirty diaper. I brought it to her attention. Now it's happened again. Okay, we're going to take care of it. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Happens again. I mean, at this point, you got to start raising the level of escalation. I mean, now we're at, if I find this one more time, I have to call the state. You know, this is when a letter, CC Joe Musso at the bottom of it, is really powerful. Because they're going to go to Google and go, who the heck is Joe Musso? Oh, he's the head of nursing home abuse litigation at Ashcraft and Jarrell.
You can use that.
You can absolutely use that. Anyone in here can use that whenever they want. I do ask that you actually copy me on the letter, though. So when they call me and go, this isn't true, I'd be like, I don't know who you are. It was a trick I taught him at a seminar. But it's levels of escalation, and you should know how to do it. And so I'm talking to you about document, document, document. I'm a big fan of, I talked to this person on this date and brought this complaint up. I then talked to this person on this date and brought this complaint up again. I then wrote a letter to you that I copied my lawyer on this date. I am now out of carrots. I am out of sticks. I have got to do something, so I'm going to go and turn you into the state, unless you have a better plan. And, you know, at that point, hopefully they're doing something. Once you're at the point where you've got to start really bringing the state in, or you need a lawyer to come in and start getting nasty with them, it's time for you to start thinking about whether or not it makes sense to stay there. And maybe it does, by the way. Don't be too quick to pull your loved one out, by the way. It causes a lot of trauma. Try to work. Try to work. It is, that's the thing, though. If you're catching them being if you're catching them being right, this is my wife's version of communication with each other. She says to me that if I say one bad thing to her, I need to say 4 good things to overcome it. And I said, does the inverse work? And she says, well, not really. So if I say 4 good things, I can't say a bad thing. But it does, my point is, if you are someone who's just bitching about everything all the time, they become tone deaf to you. But if you are, I just wanted to let you know that Sally Smith on the 3 to 11 is just the best. She actually brought her own little booties in for mom and, you know, whatever it is. And she's just so caring and so loving. And I just want it, you know, if there's a way you can go in her file, I'm happy to fill it out for you. You know, that's, you do that enough. You do that kind of thing. Just want to catch people doing things right all the time. And now you go, I'm really disappointed about what's happening on the night shift here. All of a sudden, you're not some crazed lunatic who bitches about everything. You're somebody who's very involved. You show up at different times. You've got the game. You've got your book. You know everyone's name. You will hold people accountable. You understand what your loved one's going through. You are involved in the assessment and care planning process. You are not to be trifled with. But you're not just a lunatic. You're just somebody who's going to catch them when they're doing well or bad. That's kind of where you want to be. All right. So I've given you the advocacy mindset. Know who you're talking to. Business does not want to be doing letters of correction for the state. They don't. It takes people away from doing the things that make them money. So they don't want that. When you talk to them in terms of their business, you can give them a hard time when you bring in lawyers. You can give them a hard time when you go up to the state and start making complaints, when you have ombudsmen in there poking around. When you start doing things that affect the efficiency of their business, they listen to you. When you're dealing with staff members, they want to do their job, not be harassed, not be yelled at, be complimented once in a while, and be supported in what they do. They really don't want to be fighting with family members. They don't want you turning around and reporting them to state agencies that are going to come down and their bosses are going to come down on them. So this is, you know, once you know what drives those two groups, you then can use the knowledge that you've accumulated that we've talked about to be an effective advocate, because you're going to have a notebook filled with stuff and you're going to be able to turn to them and say, no, that's not true. Actually, on October 15th, that medication was changed by Dr. Blank, and here's his number, and you know what I mean? But I wanted to share with you as I close just some specific lessons from my 20 years, okay? These are actually just very specific issues that I've actually seen in a nursing home. We've talked about this one. In the effort to be optimal, they're going to limit resources, all right? So this is, for those of you who can't make it out, that's a squeaky wheel with an oil can, all right? This is always a challenging lesson to teach because it's politically incorrect, because it necessarily requires you to be in competition to some extent with other family members and other residents, and I'm really sorry about that. I really am sorry about that. I want to live in a world where there aren't competing resources and limited resources, where one resident's going to suffer because the advocacy of the other resident's so good that that resident won't be ignored, so the resources move from this resident to this resident and that one gets harmed. I hate it. I hate it, guys. I do. But it's the truth. It's the truth. The truth of the matter is, in a world of limited resources, the one that advocates correctly will get the resources. It's the one that can show up Saturday morning at 6 a.m. just as easily as Thursday at 2 p.m. It's the one that knows the names of everybody in the facility. It's the one who knows exactly the lawyer to go to, exactly the state agency to go to, the one that wants to sit in the care plans, the one that knows the discharge rules, the one that knows when a care plan needs to be changed, knows they have a right to see it, knows they have a right, like for example in Virginia, you have a right to actually see the policies and procedures of the facility. The one that knows that they have to post their staffing level somewhere if you ask. The one who they have to give you survey results. The one that knows all of that and knows the resident and knows the medicines and knows enough to be dangerous because, oh, there's a great website, UpToDate. UpToDate.com is a great website to take any medical diagnosis, put it in there, and you can look at the physician side or the consumer side, in other words, the dumbed down version or the really scientific version, just to be enough to be dangerous with what you've got. You know, that person, the person that visits often and at varied times, and the family that knows the resident's rights, the family that will not get duped about things, the family member that insists on knowing who's taking care of their loved one, that family's resident is going to be taken care of better. I mean, if you want to just break it down to its simplest thing, I want you to just imagine an aide in a nursing home that doesn't have enough staff. In this room is, and both clients have the same exact problem. Late stage dementia, need to be fed, need to be changed, all of it. All ADLs, all activities of daily living are all dependent on staff. And there she is. And she can't do both. She just doesn't have the time. Place is understaffed today. She just doesn't have enough time. This one hasn't had a visitor in 4 weeks. And when that visitor comes in, she comes in, sits for an hour, watches some TV, and leaves. This one can pop in at any time. We see her walk in at midnight. She has a book under her arm. She knows exactly who I am. She's already talked to my boss, both good and bad, about me over the last 3 months. Think about it. What would you do if you had to? Now, your answer would be, I take care of both of them. I know. But in the world of limited resources, and when it's really not a choice sometimes, you know which one you're going to take care of. It's a sad truth, but it is the truth. I think I'm running out of time. I'm going to move quicker. When it comes to mood, drugs are a last resort. Sometimes we need them. Let me start with that, okay, before I get yelled at. Sometimes you need drugs. Sometimes it's the only answer. Sometimes you can't increase the mood. You can't beat the depression. You can't deal with the agitation. You can't handle the combativeness. And it's necessary to deal with it pharmaceutically, okay? It's the last resort, though. It's not the first resort. The question that needs to be asked is, what else have we tried? Have we tried sitting with her at night and talking to her? Have we tried letting her listen to her records that she loves? Have we tried to take her on an outing? Have we tried to bring her into more activities? Have we tried to bring activities to her? Have we tried anything besides giving her the Seroquel or the Haldol or whatever we're giving her to calm her down? I want you to become very, very skeptical, leery, whatever you want to call it. Again, doesn't mean that there aren't circumstances where it's necessary. But you should be saying to yourself, are we sure we need to give her that? Because far too often in my 20 years, I see this stuff given to them because the staff doesn't want to deal with them. They don't want to deal with some combativeness. They don't want to deal with some agitation. They don't want to have to spend time redirecting her constantly. It's much easier to pop a pill in her mouth, and now she'll sit there, docile. That is not cool. That is not good. That is not safe. It is convenient for the staff. So be aware of it. Not every time. Sometimes you have to do it, but pay attention to it. It's a last resort. Skin always tells a story. It's the largest organ in the body. In my experience, we spend so much time doing MRIs and CAT scans, and we want to know how the ejection fraction of the heart is, and how are her livers. Let's see those lab results. And all the while, you're sitting there in a room with your mom, and she's got bruises all over her, and skin tears, and her toenails are discolored, and you know her eyes are sunken, and her skin is cracked and dry, and we're just going right past it. And again, we're going right past it because, well, the nursing home thing, and well, they're old. And again, they're more than happy to tell you it's normal. Oh, we'll put some cream on that. She probably just, you know, needs a little moisturizer. No, she might be dehydrated. You know, she might be having skin tears. She might be elevated too high in bed. You might not be dealing with friction correctly when you transfer her from bed to chair. I gotta say this because I don't think you can necessarily be a nursing home abuse lawyer for 20 years and not share it with people who are interested in hearing you speak. The area of the body where the skin is the most likely to kill you is your butt. It's your tailbone, it's your sacrum. It's the one place no one wants to look at their mom. I get it. But I can't tell you how many people have sat across from me looking at a giant gaping crater to the bone packed with all sorts of awful infection and said, I had no idea that thing was there until it was way, way too late. By the time you have a stage four bed sore the size of a softball that's gone down to the bone and you're incontinent of either bowel or bladder, you're in big trouble. You've got big problems when you can't control your bowels and you've got a gigantic gaping hole access to your body. And it doesn't happen overnight. And you get to that hospital and all of a sudden the nurses at the hospital pull it back and show it to you and you go, what the heck is that? That can't happen. So you either gotta check it once a week or you gotta hire someone to. And I know you're gonna say, well, I'm already hiring someone to. No, I'm sorry, you can't. And here's why you can't. And I'll take some of the blame if you want. You know, I mean, that's what they would say. They'd say it's because of lawsuits. And you know, while I don't believe that I'm the reason why these things are happening, I'd gladly give it up if it stopped. The reality is they get sued for bed sores more than anything else. They would very much, particularly if you're one of these people with a notebook, by the way, you're one of those people who has a lawyer that they have like on speed dial if they want, that you're somebody who, you know, comes in at different times, understands everything, wants to be involved, and now all of a sudden one day when they're changing your mom, they see a little spot. They may very well just say, let's see if we can fix this first before we tell them. You know, let's see if maybe we can get it to go away. And then, and at the time, they really think they'll be no worse for wear. That they'll get it fixed up. They'll make sure they're keeping them offloaded. They'll get a wound consult. They just won't tell you yet. And then it doesn't work out so good. And the next thing you know, it's this big by the time they actually either tell you about it or some systemic infection that begins gets them in the hospital where it's finally, you know, told to you about it. You gotta check the tailbone. Sorry, but you have to. All right. Hygiene matters. It's really not that complicated, particularly if there's any kind of skin breakdown. But urinary tract infections, you know, we think of the stories that get everyone to go ooh and ah are the rapes and the broken necks and the hit by cars and freezing to death when they elope. Those are the stories that are like, oh my God. But it's the everyday terrible urinary tract infections from sitting in a dirty diaper way too long. You know, it's the the stage two wound that just gets a nasty infection because they weren't really doing a good job of hygiene. It's the C. diff infection. It's the pneumonia, the flu. It's these kinds of hygiene issues that end up taking more people than that, than broken necks and cars striking you and freezing to death outside. And again, I don't know how much I got to tell you about how to check for this. But if you come in and mom's hair stinks, there's a problem. And if mom has, you know, filth on her body and she smells, that's not normal. If you walk in the place and it smells like urine or feces all the time, that's a problem. If you smell overwhelming ammonia, or cleaning supplies all the time, again, that's something that's concerning. It means that they're kind of dealing with it after the fact. And what you really need is a preventative program where they're on top of it, so that it doesn't get to the point where the whole place has to smell like ammonia. If you come in and you look at mom's bed sheet and it has a stain on it, and a week later the same stain is there, that's a problem. Again, it requires observation. It requires being diligent. But it is really just common sense. But what I don't want you to think is, wow, they're really busy, and it's, well, she's just a little dirty. That's usually a sign of something way worse. So don't just gloss over hygiene, you know? If you've ever seen someone with oral thrush, it's awful, and it's unnecessary, and usually it can be dealt with. And, you know, it requires, though, someone to sit there sometimes and brush teeth and do the stuff that takes time and effort and pulls you away from other things. You know, I want you to know the meds. I want you to think about drug interactions. I want you to do the quick up-to-date search or the searches for contraindications on medications. It's important to know what your loved one is getting pharmaceutically. But you can't just look past nutrition. Nutrition is enormously important. And a business would much rather give you pudding cups and French fries and some bread with peanut butter on it than vegetables and, you know, fruit and good, nutritious meals. Part of your job, in my opinion, as an advocate, obviously you're going to be informed. You're going to know about swallowing issues. You're going to know about nutritional compromise that your loved one has, so you're not going to just come in and start feeding your loved one things the staff doesn't know about. You're collaborative with the staff. But bring things in. Tell the staff you're doing it, but bring things in that are healthy and maybe a little better than a business trying to catch every penny is going to give your loved one. I mean, most nursing homes' food is like the lunchroom at school. It's not the best stuff. If you can occasionally bring in some fresh fruit for mom or dad, or fresh vegetables or something good, nutrition is really important. And there's a lot of, just like with us, there's a lot of medications we can avoid and a lot of negative health outcomes we could avoid if we just managed our nutrition better. It doesn't actually change. It actually gets even more intense as you age, not less. I think I'm just about out of time. So let me skip to the end of this here. Go to interdisciplinary care plan conferences and get all the names and involve, never by phone. Always insist on an in-person in care plan conference. This shouldn't happen to you, okay? Because you should, every time you have a conversation with a caregiver, have the name, the person, the shift, and the day. So when you say, I spoke with Sally Jones on this shift, on this day, about this issue, I got it right here in my notebook, they're not going to turn to you, like Nurse Cratchit here, and say, we never said that. Bring Sudoku, is that what it's called? Your crossword puzzles. If your loved one can get out of bed, make sure they're out of bed. If your loved one can walk, make sure they're walking. If your loved one can read, make sure they read. If your loved one can listen to music, make sure they're listening to music. Physically, emotionally, psychologically, make them use what they have. Make them use what they have. All right, last thing. And then I'm going to go. And I'm sorry I run over, but I really want to read this last thing to you. So this is a poem that I think it's important for you all as you advocate for our institutionalized elderly to know that your goal is never to, it's not to return them to the health of their 20s. right? It's about giving them the best life they can have there. So this is a poem by Pat Fleming. It'll take me 2 seconds, all right? And this is, I want you to think about this poem from the perspective of your loved one and also from your perspective as a caregiver, okay? And what it means to you to be a caregiver. So let me live with the moment. Let me feel all that I can. Let me cherish life for all it's worth with everything I am. Let me see what's right in front of me with vision crystal clear and face what's waiting there for me with no hesitance or fear. May I wake each day with gratitude for all my life may be and always feel the wonderment at the world surrounding me. May I welcome any strangers with an open heart and mind and always stand for what is right with all the strength I can find. Let me forgive myself for my mistakes while forgiving others theirs and never grow indifferent but always strive to care. Let me not forget what matters in the scheme of every day, to live each precious moment in a kind and loving way. For this moment now is everything, nothing matters but today, so I'll willingly embrace it and not let it slip away. For it passes all so quickly, and one chance is all we get, and a life of wasted moments is a life filled with regret. And so with that, I thank you all for listening to me. I applaud all of you who work to make the lives of your loved ones or someone else's loved ones better. And thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes are available every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.